power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. This is a great privilege today on Church and Culture. As you listeners know, I often have guests. We talk about dead composers. Well, today we have a living composer. In fact, a few months ago we talked about three late, that is passed away, American composers, Howard Hanson, Aaron Copland, and Leo Sowerby. Today we have with us Samuel Jones, who is a student of Howard Hanson at Eastman Conservatory. Samuel Jones, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here talking with you and looking forward to this hour together.
Now, may I reveal that you were born in Inverness, Mississippi in 1935?
Yes, that may.
You went to Millsaps there and went on to Eastman School of Music.
Right.
You studied with Hanson, and you also studied conducting with William Steinberg, correct?
Yes, although Richard Laird is my major conducting teacher, a magnificent German opera conductor who came to this country in the mid-30s and escaped all the stuff.
So you represent a whole generation of American classical music in terms of your provenance, as we say. And after Eastman, you did serve as a conductor, music director of the Rochester Philharmonic for 7 years. But in 1973, you went to my home state, Houston, and you founded the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, which is quite a place now. You serve there as a founder, a dean, and a teacher for 24 years.
Right.
And I guess you had enough, then you threw in the towel, right?
Yes, then I came to the Pacific Northwest. I took early retirement, but I was dean at the Shepherd School for 7 years. I got it started, and then after the 7 years, I felt that I needed to become a full-time musician again.
I bet you did.
And
I bet you didn't compose much in those 7 years.
I didn't. I composed a music school.
Well, you then were invited to go to Seattle with the composer in residence with the Seattle Symphony and the great Gerard Schwartz for 14 years. Which led to a number of recordings with the Seattle Symphony and George Schwartz on the Naxos label. And your music, which now is over 40 works, is now making its way out through the older recordings and the new recordings. And the recordings that shows like this are going to stimulate into existence. Before we start listening, I want to tell our listeners that Sam Jones has composed one oratorio, The Temptation of Christ, which we're going to talk about on a future show, one opera based upon Truman Capote's very famous story, A Christmas Memory, for which he wrote the libretto, and we're going to be able to play excerpts from that opera, and we're hoping to stimulate interest in a revival. I mean, Truman Capote, A Christmas Memory, what a perfect opera for some opera company to pick up. Three symphonies, six concerti for solo instruments and orchestra, shorter orchestral works, works for chorus and orchestra, chamber music, and also solo music for piano. and works for children such as Eudora's Fable, that's Eudora Welty, another Mississippian, The Shoebird, which was premiered in March 2002. That actually was quite successful for you, wasn't it, Sam?
Oh, yes, it has been. Actually, it's been performed a number of places. It was recorded by the Seattle Symphony with Jay Dean,
conducted by Jay Dean.
It's a set of Mississippi first performances, but then it was
Alistair Will.
It was recorded.
Yeah,
and it was recorded later by the Seattle Symphony with the great narrator, Jim Dean. And,
Jim Dale. Oh, yeah, very famous Dale. Narrator.
Yeah,
he's done all kind of famous audio books.
And it was that recording that won a nomination for a Grammy.
There you go.
And it's gotten a lot of...
you would have been right up there on the stage with Beyonce.
What to do.
So here's what we've got, folks. We've got... this wonderful man, Samuel Jones, who's really part of the great lineage of American classical music, and you know, before that, the European heritage that came to the United States, especially in the late 1700s, early and mid 1800s, through the music schools and the composers going to France and back and forth. And we're going to listen to some of his music as an introduction in this first interview to his work, and then in future interviews we're going to explore the Temptation of Christ oratorio, we're going to explore the opera, we'll explore the children's work, the Eudora's Fable, The Shoebird, and lots of other things. So here now, Sam, I have a little bone to pick with you.
Alright.
Why did you have this very famous elegy that you wrote in response to the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the assassination.
Yes.
Which is very lovely, and it immediately engages anybody who listens to it. Okay. But instead of starting with that, we're going to play that a little later on. You picked three haiku settings, songs that are based upon haikus written by a mutual friend of ours from Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia, which are kind of, the first and third are kind of spiky, and the middle one is quite lovely and accessible. Why did you want to start with this haiku?
Well, I thought that it would be interesting on this first program of ours to spend some time with some of the very earliest works of mine at the beginning, and the second half of the program with some of the most recent, so that we give a kind of a feeling of the opening part of a parenthesis and the closing one, and at least where we are now.
When did you write these haiku settings?
I wrote them quite a while ago. It was they're among my earliest pieces. I composed them in 1959. And for a voice and a small chamber group. And then I made the piano setting in 1961, and it was premiered in Alma, Michigan later that year, where I was on the faculty at Alma College. And since then, it's been performed in a number of times and places. Probably one of the most well-known names of mezzo-sopranos, because it's for mezzo-soprano and originally mezzo-soprano and piano. The earliest, one of the earliest singers of it who loved it was Frances Bible.
Oh, yeah. She was huge. Very famous.
Yes, that's right.
She was actually a friend of my great-aunt Lucille.
You're
she was a
kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of Austin, Texas. Aunt Lucille used to talk about her.
Yeah. Well, she was one of my earliest faculty members that I hired at the Shepherd School, and mm-hmm. for several years she was a voice teacher. She had retired mm-hmm. from the performing stage at that point. In any event, so I just wanted to choose this mm-hmm. set of songs because it's among my earliest compositions.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say that it continues to have a life.
Well, let me tell our listeners that we're going to hear, the first one's only a minute long. It's entitled, We Are the Mighty Ones.
Yeah,
we're going to hear...
Let me read the words.
Okay, do that. This is a haiku, and for just remind everybody, haikus have three lines. The first and last lines have five syllables, and the middle line has seven.
Right. And the words are, we are the mighty ones. See our guns, our bombs, our broken fingernails.
And this was right in the middle of the Cold War, so let's listen to this. 1 minute long, we are the mighty ones. Fingernails. She really screeches that one out at the end, and it's relevant to the time we live in with all this saber rattling
indeed,
over in North Korea.
50 years later, and it's still
very
well. Let me say that this is performed by the Tangletown Trio. I didn't mention that I was commissioned to expand the piano voice setting into a trio setting by this wonderful chamber group in Seattle. And that's Sarah Maddox as the mezzo and Judith Cohen the piano and Joe Nardolillo playing the violin.
Well, they do a great job. We're going to hear another by the Tangletown Trio of Seattle, and it's called Ask of the Moon. And what are the words to this?
The words are, O moon that tiptoes softly on the summer sky, are the stars asleep?
Let's listen. Can almost hear the question mark in that violin at the end. Not bad for a 24-year-old composer there, Sam.
Oh, thanks, Dale.
I mean, that holds up very well. And now we're going to... And by the way, Sarah Maddox sings beautifully. That's the mezzo, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the Tango and Trio again, or Seattle, who commissioned the Trio version.
The Trio version, that's right.
Now we're going to go back. We're going to hear one last haiku, and this is the original piano setting?
That's right, that's right.
Called Migrant Bird. What are the words to
Migrant
this?
Migrant Bird, and the words to this are, Migrant bird, dipping purple wings to earth, who is your navigator?
Well, let's find out. Migrant bird. Sam Jones, you like ending on question marks here. Another.
That's the whole idea of a haiku. It leaves that question mark at the end. And
hanging in the sky.
By the way, these poems of our mutual friend John Stone, he and I were high school buddies and college buddies, very good friends. And these poems were early poems of his. They are actually not published in his 7 volumes or so of portraits
Wow.
he published. But they touched me greatly, and I remembered them and set them a couple of years later after we both graduated.
Well, now I'm glad you started with the haiku, because it demonstrates how within a minute and a half, you can create an entire musical narrative. That's got to be a great challenge.
Oh, my heavens, yes. Actually, it's something of a... You know, the music needs to match in its sense of brevity and clarity what the words do. And yet, the words are so short, you have to do something to stretch it out to make it... Even these short words are as long as the pieces that you just heard, and they're very short. But it needs to all be compatible, and it was a very interesting compositional challenge, and I still remember it, and I still remember the pleasure I had in writing them.
I'm talking with Samuel Jones, a composer from Mississippi, identified strongly with Houston because he founded the Shepherd School of Music there, and Seattle, where he's composer in residence with Seattle Symphony for 14 years. Do you remember offhand how many songs you've written?
Not very many. This is the only song set, per se. I have written a great deal for the voice, but mostly for chorus. I've written other songs, though. I wrote a wedding song for my wife now 41 years ago, and that's based on poetry of Elizabeth Brown, Barrett Brown, How Do I Love Thee, the famous...
We got to hear that sometime.
All right. Okay.
I just know the listeners want to hear that. So we have this piece written in response to the assassination of JFK. Tell us the background on this before we play it.
Well, of course, that's one of the most terrible moments that any of us who were alive at that time remember, and obviously it still has been a tremendous tragedy that the whole world knows and remembers. And there very much was a feeling that swept not only our country but the world in those dark days that followed Kennedy's assassination. I, at that time, was the conductor of the Saginaw Symphony in Michigan.
Oh.
And a couple of weeks later, I was going to perform with the symphony and the chorus a performance of Messiah. And it seemed to me that something had to happen. We couldn't just get up there and start singing Messiah. We had to recognize what everyone was feeling. And so I was discussing this with a friend of mine who was on the board of the symphony, and she said, why don't you compose something for her? And I thought, maybe I will. And I sat down, and in three sittings, three afternoons, composed the work. And it is for strings, and it is the title originally was Elegy for Elegy in Memory of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Since after that, it has become so performed so often, I should say, and it seems to speak to not only just Kennedy's death, but it's much more universal.
Elegy in general. Now, if we start playing it right now, Sam, we'll probably be able to get all of it in before the break.
Sure.
So let's listen to this elegy that was written after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And do you know who's playing this, by the way?
Yes, it's the Houston Symphony, and I am conducting it.
Okay.
And it's a recording that's still available.
That's why it's so good. Okay. The Elegy by Samuel Jones.
Thank you.
That was Samuel Jones' composition, Elegy, which he's conducting with the Houston Symphony. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pulled on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEO in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Ave Maria Radio is asking for phone volunteers for Ave Maria Radio Spring Membership Drive, April 3rd to the 7th. We start the week before Holy Week, and it's coming soon. If you or your group can spare a couple of hours of time, April 3rd to the 7th, just call Cheryl Bertil at 877-288-1077 or send her an email to volunteer@avemariaradio.net. Ave Maria Radio. Build the church. Bless the nation.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with composer Samuel Jones at the end of the last section of this interview. We listened to his beautiful elegy that he composed after the shock of assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that recording we heard was conducted by Sam Jones with the Houston Symphony, and it's available on demand from newworldrecords.org. So if you go to the newworldrecords.org website, you can order that beautiful recording along with his, which also contains his Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. And it was originally released on CRI on CD, so you might be able to find a copy of that somewhere, too. Sam, we're going to move now to what you've been concentrating on a great deal since 2006, and that is these concerti for solo instruments and orchestra.
Right.
In general, how did you sort of, you've done six of them now, and we're going to listen to parts of the violin and the cello concerto, but what moved you in this direction?
Jerry Schwartz, Gerard Schwartz. This must have been about halfway through my 14-year tenure there, which, by the way, is the longest tenure as with that title of any other person that I know of, and in American orchestral lore. It was a marvelous time working with both the orchestra and all the people involved with the orchestra, and especially with Gerard Schwartz. He was a magnificent person, wonderful conductor, great artist, and he had done a number of works of mine at that point. But he said, "I want Sam to start writing some concertos," and he engineered the first one was a Cuba Concerto, which is available on
Naxos,
by the way. Right.
The
first was a tuba concerto, and very, very successful. And Chris Oka was a magnificent soloist. And then the next was a trombone concerto for our first trombonist, Koichiro Yamamoto. And Koichiro just they both made fantastic hits with these works, And then, that was the third. The second one was the horn concerto for John Cimarron. So I did the lower brass concertos. And then next I started in on string concertos. The fourth concerto that I wrote was a cello concerto, which I wrote to commemorate the final season of Jerry's wonderful 26-year tenure, historic tenure with his Seattle Symphony. He raised its level.
We could do a whole show on how much good he did for classical music. But let's put our toe in the water here with the cello concerto. We've got three clips from it. First time I heard it, I wrote you and I said, you got a masterpiece here. It needs to be played all over the place. And I was particularly taken with the opening of the first movement. So we're going to listen to the first minute and a half of the first movement of Samuel Jones' cello concerto. The first part of the first movement of Samuel Jones' cello concerto. Because of time, I had to stop it a little short there. All that musical material is immediately engaging, grabbing, interesting, compelling. You must have gotten good response to this piece.
Oh, my heavens, yes. It's already had a number of performances since. Let me just say that about this next movement, you know, you expressed earlier in this program, my interview with you, that you would like to hear my wedding song. And actually, if we heard the whole second movement, which we won't, we're just going to hear the first minute, but I used that wedding song as the primary theme.
Oh, that's great.
Harbinger movement. So you'll get to hear the music and not the words, but you'll get to hear the music of the wedding song with the second movement of my cello concerto.
Well, let's listen to this. We're going to play the first minute of the second movement of the cello concerto of Samuel Jones. Second movement of Samuel Jones' cello concerto, which goes from a very dramatic opening statement of the concerto of the cello to a kind of conversation with the violin, the bassoon, and the other wind instruments.
I have to apologize to you. I had a slip of the memory. The quotation of the wedding song is in my cello sonata. And that's not this piece.
Well, I was kind of wondering. It sounded like a pretty turbulent wedding to me. I was going to say, now, are you the bassoon there, or are you the violin? You know, who's...
I apologize for my
that's okay.
My memory slip, but we'll get to hear the wedding.
It made us listen more closely. Now, tell us about this excerpt from the last movement of the cello concerto.
Well, actually, let's see. I think what we just heard was the development section of the first movement. Why don't you play this third excerpt, and then when we finish, I'll tell you what you heard.
Okay. Let's listen to... this is the final section of the cello concerto of Samuel Jones. The finale of the cello concerto of Samuel Jones. Now, tell us what we heard.
Yes, you heard the big cadenza at the end, and then getting back into the final whirlwind ending. I have to tell you that this magnificent cellist who played the premiere and then did the television performance with the All-Star Orchestra later His name is Julian Schwartz, and if you think that the name Schwartz is familiar, it is. Julian is indeed the son of the conductor. And he is now a fine young conductor. You even can't say young anymore because of the stature of his playing. He is a wonderful concert artist, and right now is touring China and has won the various awards. He's a magnificent person, as is his father, and as you heard, a magnificent cellist and wonderful musician.
Sure is. Speaking of magnificent performers,
yes,
the woman who is playing your violin concerto.
Anna Kiko Myers is her name, and she is a magnificent violinist. And we are about to demonstrate that with these excerpts.
Now, would you say there's any basic contrast in style between the concerto for cello and the one for violin that we're about to hear?
Well, there's certainly a great deal of similarity in that, I think they both bespeak my basic compositional style. The main difference is in the nature of the instruments themselves. The different voices, and they both are capable of incredible lyricism and great lyrical beauty, as well as incredible technical demands. And that's the challenge. As you're writing a concerto, you want to write something that is something of a tightrope for the soloist to walk, because that's part of the thrill of hearing a fine artist play a concerto.
Well, our listeners ought to know that this was premiered only February 2016, and in a broadcast, it was nationwide on public broadcasting.
That's right. And with this all-star orchestra that Jerry Schwartz has brought into existence, it's mostly first-chair players of various orchestras all around the country. I think there was something like 13 different concert masters playing in the violin.
Wow, and there is a DVD of this performance available at Amazon. But let's listen to the opening section of the first movement of the Violin Concerto of Samuel Jones. Your violin concerto, Sam, has all the makings of a great violin concerto. You've got that kind of tightrope walking, writing for the solo violin, the virtuoso challenge, but you've also got great themes entering in from the orchestra, then taken up by the violin, and that's what a concerto is supposed to be, right? A conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dale, for the compliment. Yes, indeed it is. By the way, I should mention that this concerto, the three movements, in a big general way, have a certain inspiration in the three deep ideas from St. Paul, from the 1 Corinthians in chapter 13, faith, hope, and love. Although I inverted the faith and the hope, and the hope is kind of the overriding idea of the first movement.
Yeah, we won't burn you at the stake for that.
Yeah. So that's, you know.
If that's the case, then the second movement that we're about to hear, part of it would be the hope movement?
No, because I inverted it. The hope movement is the first movement. In my opinion, hope and it followed by faith, and then love I don't know. I like the order of that better.
Okay. Hope's a firm confidence that good lies in the future, and everything follows from that. So let's listen to what Sam Jones thinks a faith ought to sound like with a violin and an orchestra. Was the first part of your second movement, your faith movement of your violin concerto. And let me just, it came to me while I was listening to that beautiful playing, that the thing that I like so much about your compositions is that you have the ability to create what I would call musical cells, melodic cells. Some people would call them tunes. But they're arresting. They're not banal. They're not kitschy. They're arresting melodic cells, which then you develop in ways that are surprising and interesting and not at all predictable. So it gives you the sense of being drawn in and then the beauty to the ear, but at the same time, just interesting emotionally and intellectually to follow along.
Well, what a wonderful thing to hear you say. I think it's so important to reach out, that all art, but particularly music, needs to reach out to the heart. It has to be interesting to the mind as well. And the greatest musical works appeal to both. And you're intellectually drawn to it, but at the same time you are deeply moved. And when that combination hits just right, it transcends words, which, of course, the greatest music.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah.
Listeners, we're talking and listening to the music of Samuel Jones, 82 years young. And let's listen, before we run out of time, to the end of the violin concerto, the final movement. We didn't quite reach the end of Samuel Jones' Violin Concerto because I would not want to say goodbye abruptly to a Mississippi gentleman such as Sam. Sam, I want our listeners to know, again, that this is only the first of a series of interviews, radio shows we're going to do together, and I think this is a great introduction to your work, to your legacy, and we'll look forward to having you back, and we'll do the oratorio, the opera, some of the chamber music, orchestral works. Promise you'll come back.
Well, I certainly will, Dale. It'll be a pleasure, and it has been a pleasure. I've enjoyed sharing my music with you and with our listeners.
Thank you, Sam. And for all of you who are listening, please hang around. We have another great guest after this short break.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor. In thanksgiving for the Sisters of Mary, Mother of Divine Grace in Port Sanilac, Michigan, as they make their final profession today on the Solemnity of the Annunciation. Like Mary, the sisters gave their yes to bring Jesus to the world, and we wish them the greatest of blessings as they live out their charism for Christian unity.
Why would God permit the devil to tempt his son in the desert? The symbolism behind those temptations, as provided by the Catholic Catechism, gives great insight into God's rationale. Jesus, driven by the Spirit, goes into the desert to live in solitude for 40 days. At the close of that period of prayer and fasting, the devil arrives to attempt to compromise Jesus' filial devotion to God his Father. Satan tempts Jesus three times, and Jesus rebuffs him three times. This is a recapitulation of Satan's seduction of Adam. Only this time he loses to the new Adam. It is also a recapitulation of Israel in the desert when the Hebrews provoked God during their 40-year sojourn. In contrast, Jesus is totally obedient to his Father's will. Jesus' victory over temptation is a prelude to his victory over sin on the cross. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The story of Christian higher education in America is a sad saga. Once upon a time, our universities were run by religious people or founded with religious missions. Not anymore. And yet a few jewels have held firm to the foundation. Two colleges that have actually heightened their faith commitment are Franciscan University of Steubenville and Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where I teach, one Roman Catholic and the other Protestant. The period when the two institutions successfully struggled to retain their faith commitments came in the 1970s and 1980s under the long-term leaderships of two particular presidents, Father Michael Scanlon and Dr. Charles McKenzie. My occasion for mentioning this now is the death of Father Scanlon at the age of 85. For 37 years, he led Franciscan. But I want to report an interesting and unseen ecumenical item related to Scanlon's and McKenzie's efforts, a joint effort. During some trying days, Scanlon and McKenzie frequently exchanged phone calls, advising and encouraging one another. Here were Catholics and Protestants working together, united by a common secular foe. Father Scanlon and I were on the same wavelength, McKenzie told me, as we sought to lead our schools back to the roots of the Christian faith. We were very careful what we said to each other. We were on the same side in many of the issues, unquote. Indeed, we are still, from marriage to unborn life. McKenzie called Scanlon a man of courage and faith, a blessing to me. I thank God for him. And so do the folks at Franciscan University, which today, like Grove City College, is a shining light amid the darkness of higher education. Both Scanlon and McKenzie ensured that those lights were not extinguished under a bushel of secular relativism. They met not as antagonists from opposing Catholic and Protestant trenches, but as allies against a common foe. It's a tale of two Christian colleges that Catholics and Protestants alike can learn from and emulate. For Ave Maria Radio, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, Takedown, on the ideological sabotage of family and marriage.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture.